This is Robert Rogers from Parkinson's Recovery, and it's my pleasure and honor to be able to interview Dr. Jaroslav Bublik today. So I first have a series of general questions about dehydration, and then we have many, many people who are listening to this teleseminar who actually are taking the AQUAs, and so I have some very specific questions about the AQUAs from a number of individuals. So first to the more general questions. It is silly to have a teleseminar devoted to dehydration, one person says. The answer is simple. I can hydrate my body by forcing myself to simply drink 8, 12, 14 glasses of water every day. So what's the big deal about dehydration?
If it was as simple as simply drinking more water, a lot more people would be a lot more hydrated than they are. It's pretty clear to me, looking around at the people in the world around me, that it's not that simple. Simply forcing yourself to drink more water, you know, it may have a short-term transient impact on your state of hydration. But the analogy I make is, and many people that work in office spaces will be familiar with the sad and sorry potted plant in the corner of the boardroom. Which really gets neglected pretty badly. And the fact is, if you water that potted plant, chances are most of the water will simply flow through it and end up in a puddle on the floor. I think many of us are like that potted plant. We've been neglected for so long in terms of providing adequate amounts of hydrating fluids into the system that when we do pour a large amount in, most of it simply flows through. And certainly it is many people's experience when they decide, you know, they have an epiphany and they decide that they're going to get really hydrated and start drinking their 8 or 10 or 12 glasses of water a day, that they find that all the only real impact on them is the fact that they spend a lot more time going to the bathroom. This suggests to me that, and has long, and we've supported this with research, this has long been shown by us to be the fact that there are two pathways of hydration in the body. There is short path and long path hydration. Short path is into the body, into the mouth and into the digestive tract, into the circulation, straight into the kidneys and then down to the bladder and out, with very little of that fluid ending up impacting the hydration of the actual individual cells. And then there's long path hydration, where that circulating fluid does manage to get out of the circulation into extracellular fluid, then into the cells, where it carries nutrients in, and then back out of the cells, where it carries toxins out, back into the circulation, and then through the kidneys to the bladder. And that long path hydration is what we're looking for, and that unfortunately does get switched off with neglect. And simply pouring more water into the system doesn't switch it back on again. And you need to take some sort of proactive step. We believe that AQUAs are a good example of that, but there are probably other things that you can do to provoke that long path hydration.
Why is it that as we age, our bodies become more and more dehydrated, or at least it seems that's the case?
Well, that's an interesting question, and it may well be that we're looking at that question the long way around. Maybe it is that our bodies age because they become more and more dehydrated. I would put it to you that perhaps if we're able to maintain the levels of hydration in the cells, then many of the age-related process of degeneration would actually be slowed. So it's certainly true that dehydration, increasing dehydration and aging go hand in hand, but perhaps it is that we should be looking at that question from the point of view of making sure that we stay hydrated, and in doing so, that process will actually be slowed. I'm not sure we can stop it completely because there are other factors at play here, and I'm not saying that hydration is the only factor that's important in the aging process, but certainly it is a significant one, and I think if we can manage it, then we can gain some anti-aging benefits.
Why is it that a well-hydrated body is so essential to being able to eliminate toxins in the body?
Well, I guess the analogy that I like to make here is for you to think about the ebb and flow of the tide. The water that's available in the body is a major amount of moving matter that is able to move in and out of cells. And it is, in fact, the mechanism by which all nutrients are brought into cells and also all toxins are taken out of cells. If the volume or the mass of water that's moving in and out of cells is low, then the ability for nutrients to be taken into the cells is reduced and the ability of toxins to be removed from the cells is reduced. So simply increasing the available mass of fluid that can move in and out of cells will both improve the uptake of nutrients and also the clearance of toxins. So it's very important for the body to be well hydrated to facilitate the clearance of toxins.
There is a great deal of interest in understanding different ways a person can go about hydrating their body, and I've got a list of, most of them are foods or beverages, and I'd like to give these to you so that you can give us some perspective on how much they help or hurt the hydration process. The first on my list is salt. And so the idea here is, if I just eat really salty foods, that'll make me thirsty and I'll drink more water.
Good idea. A little flawed, because the issue there is that with the intake of the salt and primarily the sodium in the salt, the body seeks to maintain the concentration of sodium in tissues across a very narrow range. And the way it does that, certainly if you take too much salt into the body, is to turn up the thirst reflex so that you consume a proportion more fluid and therefore dilute out the sodium that's present in the system and ultimately flush it through to the kidneys where it can be released. So simply taking more salt, there may be a couple of instances, exercising very hard in high temperatures where there's a lot of salt loss that can exacerbate the dehydration effect of that exercise. Maybe a situation where some additional salt intake might help hydration homeostasis, but in most cases, using additional salt to simply promote more drinking will not result overall in an increased hydration state.
What about energy drinks?
Well, with energy drinks, we have a couple of issues. Firstly, we have the fact that they do contain fluid, so that's a good thing. Secondly, we have the fact that they do contain electrolytes, and with what we've just said about sodium, that can be appropriate where those electrolytes are necessary, but it can also be unhelpful where they're not. And thirdly, energy drinks contain calories in the form of carbohydrate. In the process of metabolizing that carbohydrate, generates some new water in the body. So carbohydrate is composed of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. We breathe in additional oxygen. We use that to burn the carbohydrate, and we end up with carbon dioxide, which we expire, and some water fraction. So it's possible to carry some extra water into the body by the burning of that carbohydrate. But fundamentally, the problem for most people is that they don't completely burn the carbohydrate. They have some residual carbohydrate, and those extra calories, you know, may not in fact be helpful for the individual. But the source of fluid in energy drinks probably makes them quite useful, but for most people, except those who really need that extra energy and the electrolytes, something like water or dilute fruit juices are probably a better way to hydrate.
How about coffee and tea?
The issue with coffee and tea, and we should probably include in this part of the story alcoholic beverages, is that caffeine and many of those xanthine-type compounds and alcohol have a diuretic effect. So they will, in fact, turn up the gain on the filtering capacity of the kidneys, and the consequence of that is that we end up losing fluid from the system through this diuretic effect. So very weak tea, green tea, dilute tea-based drinks are probably okay in moderation, but the stronger coffee and certainly stronger alcoholic beverages probably result generally in a net water loss with the consequence of increased dehydration.
Next on my list is soft drinks like colas.
Well, again, they contain generally carbohydrate. So for many people, those additional calories are not something they necessarily need. In the case of cola in particular, cola does often contain amounts of caffeine. Cola drinks often contain amounts of caffeine, and in fact, caffeine is hidden in many soft drinks these days. So that has a diuretic effect. And so, look, I don't certainly have any kind of prohibition on soft drinks, but I think there are better choices that you can make if you're looking to hydrate than soft drinks.
How about milk?
Look, milk is a perfectly good hydrating beverage. If it's something that the individual can tolerate, there are a lot of people these days who have various food intolerances, of which lactose is a common one, and so conventional cow's milk may not be appropriate. But for those that do tolerate milk, it can, be an adequate source of fluid. It does contain some protein and some calories, and so again, for those people who are concerned about their calorie intake, it may not be the ideal choice when given the alternative of something as simple as water, but there's certainly nothing wrong with it. And, for someone who is desiring some additional calcium in their diet, and perhaps it's useful, although there are some questions, I think, around our ability to absorb calcium from dairy foods anyway, for many of us.
What really are the symptoms of dehydration? Many people tell me, well, I don't know whether I'm dehydrated or not. How would they be able to know?
Well, I think the reason that dehydration is such a difficult issue to really manage is that the symptoms are not particularly obvious until the level of dehydration is quite extreme. So if you encounter someone who is significantly dehydrated in an acute way, that is, they've been out, exercising hard at high temperatures, or they've simply had no fluid intake for a lengthy period of time, then typically they'll be tired, they'll be lethargic in terms of being able to maintain any muscle tone. They will often be confused. But this is an extreme sort of end state level of dehydration. That's not where most people are most of the time. Most of us are at a point where we are only fractionally dehydrated. And the symptoms of that are much harder to pick. For some people, there are a whole series of little tests that people can use, and certainly which physicians can use to identify the advancing stages of dehydration, including picking up a small amount of skin on the back of the hand between the thumb and the forefinger and seeing how quickly it returns when you let it go. So you pick up a little roll of skin and let it go. It's not a particularly accurate way of measuring dehydration, and certainly depends a lot on other factors like the age of the person and so on. It's a way that you can monitor, I guess, to some degree. But overall, those are about the limit in terms of being able to measure these things by symptomatology. We have scientific techniques for measuring the relative state of hydration, but obviously they're not available to most people. So the simplest way to address the issue is to make sure that you take steps to maintain an optimal level of hydration at all times, and never allow these signs and symptoms to creep into your experience. And I know that's kind of avoiding the question, but the reality is for most of us that's the best way to approach it.
You have lived in many different places in the world, Australia and San Diego. Are there really any differences in the water that you find in different locations in the world? Or is water, water, water? Is it all the same?
Look, I think there are significant differences as I travel around. I think the biggest differences I see is between water in places where the water catchments are very close to the point of end use. So in a place like Melbourne, where I come from, we have mountain catchments not very far from the city, and so the water quality is pretty good out of the tap. Having said that, for the last few years, we've had a drought in southeastern Australia, and the amount of water that's flowing into the catchments has been reduced, and so the water authorities have taken the decision some time ago to chlorinate the water in order to protect the water bacteriologically for the end user. Other places I've been to in the world where the amount of chlorine protection varies makes the water either usable or not. Here in Southern California, frankly, I have a pretty hard time drinking the tap water. We certainly use a water filter here or buy bottled water for consumption. But there are, you know, plenty of places in the world where the tap water is probably of adequate quality. And really, I guess that's something that each person needs to look at in their own particular area. What I would say about these various water protection additives such as chlorine is that I always use the analogy of going to the supermarket to buy something perishable like some meat or some chicken or some fish. And typically in a modern supermarket, that's presented to you on a little styrofoam tray with some plastic wrap around it. And nobody would consider going home and simply throwing the whole package in the pan or on the barbecue. You always remove the packaging that has been put there to protect that perishable item from bacteriological exposure. And I think we should look at water the same way. Water is a sensitive product that will readily pick up contamination from whatever environment it's in. And so the water authorities, I think, quite wisely protect it. In the case of water, they do that by putting additives in. And I think we should remove those additives in the same way that we remove the packaging on the meat before we use the water. If you're fortunate to live in an area where there's no packaging around your water, well and good. Go ahead and use it. But if you're in an area where there is these additive chemicals, then you should certainly look at removing them in some way. And an appropriate water filter is a good way to do that. And failing that, I think prepackaged bottled water where the packaging is in fact the package and it's much easier to remove is a better way to approach the issue of quality water.
Some people approach the challenge of dehydration using structured water products, which are more and more found out in the marketplace. Can you say something about what these products really are and how they help?
Water is a very interesting material. People talk about water as H2O, two hydrogen atoms bound to an oxygen atom. But the reality is that liquid water, the type that we drink, has in fact a whole range of higher order structures. So typically in a nice pure form of liquid water, those H2O molecules are associated into rings and chains and clusters. And it is this hydrogen bonding between individual water molecules that gives water some of its particular biophysical properties, such as surface tension and its solvent capacity and these sorts of things. A number of people have attempted to, address the issue of higher order structure in water by producing what are purported to be structure-modified waters. So the thinking here is that in a very pure water, which has been recently condensed from the gas phase, So that's rainwater in a cloud, or perhaps even the water that falls in a mountain stream. The clusters are reasonably small in size. Typically, you know, the smallest cluster we'd typically find would be 6 water molecules in a ring. But often larger clusters than that are found in that kind of water. But as water is run through pipes, stored in dams or reticulation systems, or in packaging for that matter, it's understood that larger order structures do form. And one of the hypotheses is that these larger structures have a more difficult time penetrating into cell walls and passing through cell membranes, and therefore are inferior in terms of conducting nutrients into cells. In response to that concept, certain companies have developed methodologies for creating structured waters where the water clusters are said to be smaller. So even down to the point where there are some companies that claim to have water clusters of just 5 water molecules. Now, I think this is a very interesting concept. There is a certain amount of science that supports the possibility of creating small water clusters, but thermodynamically they're not particularly stable, and water has a tendency to always accrete into larger order structures. So the ability of something that is a small cluster to stay as a small cluster in a package so that it can end up in that form in the hands of the end user, I think are still under something of a question. And so I don't particularly go looking for those sorts of structured waters. I think there are some technologies now available for creating particular structured waters in situ, so that you would put conventional water in at one end of some sort of device, and out of the other end of the device you would get some structure-modified water. That may, assuming that technology works, that may be a better way of going about it than buying pre-packaged structure-modified waters. But I think the jury is still very much out as to how well these approaches optimise the hydrating capacity of the water. So you know, I remain a little sceptical about that whole area.
I've got a series of questions about what good hydration in the body can do. Can good hydration address the symptoms of diseases?
Look, I think hydration is such a fundamental issue in the human body that it is inevitable that at some level they are implicated in many disease states. Now, as to how direct and causal that relationship is, I think that probably varies across a range of diseases, but you know, I think most people would accept that in order to be truly well, we need to have adequate amounts of nutrition of all of the sort of major nutrient groups. So we need adequate amounts of vitamins and adequate amounts of minerals and appropriate amino acids and essential fatty acids and so on and so forth. I think it's important that we think of water as a nutrient. I think it's a critically important nutrient, in fact, arguably the most critically important nutrient. And so making sure that we have adequate amounts of it available for all the processes that it's involved with, I think, is you know, of undeniable importance in terms of creating wellness. Now, how much water is implicated in particular disease states? Well, at the very acute end of things, if you are acutely significantly dehydrated, it's life-threatening. We can live without oxygen for but a few minutes. We can live without water for really only a matter of 20 to 40 hours. We can live without most food-borne nutrients for literally days. So water is clearly a critically important nutrient in that acute situation. How much water is implicated in other diseases? Well, there have been a number of commentators who have said that water or dehydration, lack of water, is implicated in virtually all disease states. I'm probably pretty comfortable with that as a concept. I think certainly, you know, diseases of, of the excretion processes in the body, kidney disease and these sorts of things, water probably has a very important role to play. You know, when we come, and the topic partially of today is talking about Parkinson's, I think, you know, all we can say is that since we've had the tool in our hands of the aqua formulas, which has allowed us to intervene in or hypothetically intervene in the hydration process in the body, and we have seen some impact of that on the progression and development of Parkinson's symptoms in certain people, then I would certainly suggest that there's some linkage between the state of hydration and Parkinson's disease. But exactly whether that's a causal relationship remains, I think, to be borne out in much more sophisticated research than what we've done so far.
Can good hydration improve mental clarity?
Again, I think I'd probably answer this by citing the opposite situation. I know for myself, when I was training for the marathon, that when I became significantly dehydrated, as was the case before I had access to the formulas, I could experience a significant drop in mental clarity as I became more and more dehydrated, to the point where I didn't even have the clarity of mind to consume more water, which is a pretty, you know, important thing to do when you're dehydrated. So I think mental clarity is certainly something that disappears with increasing dehydration. Now, on a day-to-day basis, at the more modest alterations of hydration state that we would see in day-to-day life, look, I actually think it is pretty important. As a neuroendocrinologist and a neuroscientist, you know, one thing that you can say about the central nervous system is that it's a pretty wet place. Most of the tissues in there are 99% plus water, and I think we would then assume that all we have to do is perturb that environment by a small fraction to see dramatic changes in how well the environment operates. And so I think I'd be very comfortable to say that reduced hydration has an impact on mental clarity.
Can good hydration improve digestion?
I think that, again, here I have a lot of anecdotal evidence for this with the work that we have been doing with the aquas over the last 15 years. Probably one of our most common testimonials that we receive from people is that it has that getting on the aqua formulas and improving hydration has had an effect on their digestive processes. One place where hydration or the presence or availability of water certainly has an impact is on the activity in the colon. The colon is the most terminal part of the digestive system, is one of the few areas of the body where water can be resorbed from the external environment. And certainly people who are dehydrated will frequently experience changes in the frequency of bowel movements. And if that is rectified by proper hydration, then that will often address that problem very, very quickly. So at that end of things, certainly. Now, if we go back up to the top of the digestive system, to the stomach, it would appear that maintaining an adequate level of hydration is critically important in the appropriate secretion of gastric acid. So when you first consume food, the first thing the body does is begin the digestive process with an outpouring of gastric acid. And in a dehydrated individual, that gastric acid is of reduced volume and lesser quality. And therefore, that digestive process does not get off to a good start. Now, as to what happens in between, not enough research, I think, has been done. But given the importance of the bacterial ecology of the rest of the digestive tract, I suspect that maintaining a proper level of hydration throughout the digestive tract is probably pretty important, if not critical, to digestive function.
Can good hydration soften skin tissue and texture and make us look younger?
I think, Robert, this is probably one of the hot button issues for so many people. Here in Southern California, we have or in San Diego, particularly, we have a local newspaper called The Reader. When I lived here in the mid '80s, most of the advertisements in The Reader were for places to go and drink and party on a Friday night. Now, virtually all of the advertisements in The Reader are for plastic and reconstructive surgery, which suggests to me there's been a wholesale change in the attitude of people in Southern California. I don't want people to think that they can take the Aquas and look 20 years younger. However, I think maintaining a proper level of hydration can absolutely make a difference to the appearance of the skin. The skin is a hydrated tissue, just like all the tissues in our body. As it becomes dehydrated, it exhibits some very obvious signs of dehydration, and that little skin fold test that I talked about earlier is a classic example of exactly the sort of thing that that the skin will manifest. So, I think maintaining good levels of hydration can make a difference there. But whether or not this is the magic look 20 years younger pill, I don't know.
Can good hydration control a person's body weight?
The studies that have been done on the mechanisms that provoke the behavioral responses around consumption of food suggest that in people where their hydration status has been ignored for a long period of time, there can be central nervous system confusion between a thirst response or a thirst cue and an eating cue. So to explain that a little more, we have a filtration, an information filtration system in our brains called the reticular activating system, and it's this system that allows us to filter out extraneous information and allow us to focus on particular issues. So the best example of this is that if you're in a crowded room and you can often hear your name being spoken across the other side of the room, even though you weren't aware that those people were talking about you. What's going on here is that you're actually taking in all the information across the whole room, but you're filtering most of it out. Most of it's not winding up in your consciousness. But when your name pops into the conversation, that comes straight through that filter. Now, think about that filter acting on the responses that your body's tissues keep sending out for you to drink more water or eat more food. And again, if you ignore these things over a long period of time, which is typically what people who are dehydrated will do, then that filter actually gets very good at filtering out a thirst cue and calling it noise. And so there is a potential, at least, for confusion between, you know, an I am thirsty message and an I am hungry message. And certainly what we've observed in practice in certain people who have started using the formulas and getting better hydrated is that they become much better at differentiating what is an I am thirsty message from an I am hungry message, with the consequence that they drink more but eat less, and this has an impact on their body composition. Now, it's certainly not the case with everybody, but I think in certain individuals where that is the reason for their body composition, then, you know, this can actually have quite a profound effect.
Carl from Portland asks, how do you know if you are taking too little or too much of the Aqua drops?
You probably can't know if you're taking too little, except that they won't be having their desired effect. As far as taking too much, in someone who is otherwise well, we've found that there is probably no real upper limit on the amount that you can use. I've certainly, in trials, used significant amounts of the formula with no real deleterious effects, nor, might I add, any additional effect. So there is a threshold for the effect, which can't be pushed any further by increasing the dose. I would say, however, that certainly the research that John Coleman's been doing with people with Parkinson's disease, the situation is very different. And so I want to caution those listeners who have that range of conditions that they should use the formulas with a great deal of care initially until they have determined what is an appropriate dose for them. And we've been surprised, actually, by how small those doses sometimes are. In the case of John himself, he started out using one drop of the formulas. Normally, I would use 6 to 7 drops, typically morning and evening, and he found that one drop already had quite a profound effect on him. So we certainly recommend that in someone who wants to use these formulas to manage a situation such as Parkinson's disease, it's probably best to engage with an appropriately qualified and experienced health professional. You can do that online with John himself, and I think there are a number of other health professionals elsewhere in the world now who have gained some experience with the use of the formulas and can advise on those things. But for people who are otherwise well, I mean, our recommendation of 5 to 7 drops seems to be an optimal dose for most people, and that's the reason we recommend it, obviously. But for people with those range of conditions, some care must be taken.
Carl from Portland also asks, how does the aqua drops help improve PD symptoms?
That is a very good question, and it's one that I would probably hand pass to someone like John, who has far more experience in this area. I will give my perspective on it, and that is that we spoke earlier about the central nervous system, and clearly Parkinson's exists as a consequence of some deterioration of certain parts of that central nervous system, and it makes sense to me, although we're yet to demonstrate this mechanistically, that if you hydrate the organism, you hydrate the central nervous system, and if you hydrate the central nervous system, then some of the deficits that accrue as a consequence of the advancing condition may be slowed. How exactly that works at a cellular level, or even more importantly at a biomolecular level, we still don't really know enough about this whole area to comment in any meaningful way. But and the reality is that even within the group of people who have used the aqua formulas as an adjunct to the management of these sorts of conditions, not everyone is a responder. So it's clear that we're not impacting the fundamental mechanism, but obviously are able in some cases to impact some of the consequential mechanisms. So I can't really comment in any more detail than that on that one.
Elisa from Austin, Texas. How can you tell if the aqua hydration formula is succeeding? Is there a test that can show that your tissues and or cells are adequately hydrated?
For Lisa, there certainly are some diagnostic tools that can be used to measure whole body hydration. There are simple techniques such as weight. These are fraught with a lot of error, so they're probably not useful in most situations except extremely well-controlled situations. There are techniques such as bioimpedance measurements, where we actually measure the impedance of an electrical current that's sent through the body and use that to determine body composition and from that hydration. But none of these techniques, all of these techniques look at whole body hydration. None of them look at hydration of, for instance, the central nervous system, or in particular, the tissues or cells that may be affected in a condition such as Parkinson's. So that's a long answer for what really probably could have been shortened to, no, there are no techniques you can use to measure these things for a Parkinson's patient. We have done measurements using other techniques such as kinesiological biofeedback mechanism type tests, and they could be quite useful, and certainly people that have access to a well-qualified and experienced practitioner who is able to do kinesiological measurements may get some information about how they're going on any particular therapeutic strategy by making those sorts of measurements. But as far as an analytical measurement or something like that, there's nothing that we can do at this stage.
David from Lillywhop, Washington. If possible, simply describe how cells tell each other their situation. For example, when one cell begins to get hydrated, how does the cell let other cells know they might be faced with the same condition?
There are multiple mechanisms by which cells talk to one another. We can probably use the analogy of us in modern society. We have, most of us, multiple ways of communicating with other people. We can stand face-to-face with them and simply speak. If we're in the vicinity, perhaps use things like sign language and so on. As we get further apart from people, we can use tools such as the telephone or email. We can communicate across broader groups of people with the mass media, newspapers and television. So there are multiple ways that humans communicate. Cells are pretty much the same. Cells can talk when they're close to one another using the equivalent of speech and or sign language or hand signals. And this makes use of certain cell surface proteins, which a cell that has undergone some changes can modify their cell surface proteins, and the neighbouring cell can detect those changes and respond accordingly. Across broader distances, and we're talking still microscopic distances in tissues, cells can secrete hormones that can affect cells, you know, at whatever distance the hormone can be active in. These can be local hormones, local tissue factors and so on, right through to systemic hormones that are secreted by endocrine tissues into the circulation and spread through the whole body. We have a nervous system, and the nervous system allows cells in one part of the body to generate some kind of signal that's transmitted via the nervous system to other parts of the body. So we have, I guess, analogous systems to speech, to telephone and email, and to mass media communication going on in our bodies all the time. Now, exactly how a cell that has become dehydrated or a cell that has been dehydrated and subsequently become more hydrated communicates that change of state to the cells surrounding it is something that isn't well known. There is a series of hormones. These are local tissue factors rather than long-distance circulating hormones that are secreted by cells as cells change their hydration state, and these can result in the neighbouring cells responding by either opening up water channels in their membranes to take up more available extracellular fluid or closing them down. So that's the local effect. Now, we also have a whole series of very potent endocrine hormones that are secreted by pituitary and hypothalamus that are circulated all through the body that impact receptors on virtually every type cell type in the body that notify the cell of the global hydration status, the global sodium status, and so on. So it's a pretty complex interplay between these local factors and these large-scale, long-distance endocrine hormones.
Brenda from Honolulu asks, why won't the aquas work diluting it in just water?
Well, the aquas work perfectly well diluting in water. Our recommendation has always been that the aquas in our hands, and these were a series of kinesiological studies done on a variety of subjects. In our hands in those studies, the aquas worked better when put into a drink which contained some source of fructose. Now, when we looked further into the mechanism here, the fructose was useful in terms of getting the fluid from the gastrointestinal tract out into the circulation, because a number of the channels by which fluid leaves the gut and enters the circulation are saccharide triggered channels. So fructose is a sugar and triggers those channels quite nicely. So that's the reason for the suggestion that one uses dilute apple juice and water as a vehicle for the aquas. But I have to say that I've put the aquas into virtually everything that you can drink out of a glass, and they work to a greater or lesser degree in most things, and they certainly work perfectly well in water. And when I'm travelling, for instance, I will typically just put my aquas into a water bottle and sip that water bottle throughout the flight, and experience a quite different level of jet lag and post-flight dehydration when I do that than when I don't do that. So putting them into water is perfectly fine.
Is that the AM or the PM that you do when you're doing the flying?
I generally use the PM when I'm flying. Again, no real rationale for that apart from the fact that in testing, the PM seems to work better in flight. I would say, however, if people are choosing to use the aquas as an aid to long-distance travel, that as soon as they arrive in their destinations, they start using the AM and PM formulas according to local time. And in fact, I've done some experiments where I've started using, particularly, for instance, flying Australia to the United States, I've started using the AM and PM formulas according to the time of my destination for a couple of days prior to flying. And there does seem to be some benefits in doing that in terms of resetting the body clock when you get to the destination, but certainly in flight I use the PM.
Lola from Winstead, what type of water do you recommend people drink daily who are on the Aquas program? And there's a list of choices here: filtered, distilled, purified, spring, or some other type of water?
My recommendation is that you drink the best quality water that you can get your hands on. Now, that will vary from person to person. If you are in a situation where you can afford a high-quality in-home filtration system, I think that's probably in the long term the best and most cost-effective way of having good quality water to drink and to cook with. Having said that, it's important that any filtration system is properly maintained over its lifetime to ensure the quality of the water that you're getting out of it. For people that can't afford a high quality, and the high quality ones are expensive, high quality water purification system, then an appropriately filtered bottled water is probably almost as good. Distilled water has certain applications. I don't think drinking large amounts of it is something that I would recommend, simply because distilled water will generally result in a net movement of electrolytes into the water when that water arrives in the body. In small amounts, I don't think that's a problem, but I think using large amounts of distilled water can theoretically at least deplete some of those electrolytes. And for someone that has a particular reason for doing that, that may in fact be a good thing to do, but generally I wouldn't recommend it. Spring water, if you have real access, if you're fortunate enough to live in a place where you have access to a genuine clean spring, then there's probably no better water on earth. But that would be a very small percentage of the people that I know on this planet. So if you're in that situation, good luck to you, and certainly spring water would be fine. But for the rest of us that live in big cities, a good water filter, I think, is the number one choice.
Dr. Vora Vanadera from India says the following: as a part of my Parkinson's treatment, I take Aquas one drop in the morning and the evening, and drank 8 to 10 glasses of water for a period of 3 months. I feel if I increase my dose, my body reacts. For how long should I have to take the Aquas?
It's a really good question, and I guess it refers to the exact effect that certainly John Coleman has observed, and we have heard of from many people with who have been using the Aquas with their Parkinson's recovery program. As far as exactly how long she may need to continue taking the Aquas at that level, I really don't have an answer for that. I suggest that it's as long as it takes. It may well be that one drop is all she'll ever need to use, and that will deliver to her the benefits that she needs. So I'm not suggesting that increasing the amount of the Aquas in her situation would gain any additional benefit. You know, I mean, I guess the only way to test that is to periodically perhaps check in and just see whether a higher dose is required and or beneficial. This is where working with an appropriately qualified practitioner, I think, is a great thing, because a technique such as kinesiology can be used to, without actually necessarily exposing the person to that higher dose, just check in and see whether a higher dose would be advantageous or not. If she's getting the benefits that she needs from one drop morning and evening, then that's the dose that she should be using, and until another piece of information comes along to change that.
Many people have questions about homeopathy and exactly how it works. And moreover, the concern is, I take one drop from each of these bottles every day, and that's supposed to do something. Why isn't it the case that taking more drops is going to be better for me?
I guess even now, 15 years after I was first exposed to homeopathy, it's one that I still, as a scientist, get slightly twitchy with. But here's my honest answer to this. I've used homeopathic remedies now in as far as their presence in the aqua formulas for all that time, and in addition, I have used homeopathy many, many times through that 15-year period to manage other issues. I've also used things like flower essences, which I think work along similar energetic lines, and so I've come to believe from an experiential point of view that these things work. Now, how exactly they do work is something that I'm not sure I have the deep understanding to answer comprehensively. My understanding in a broad sense is that we're talking about subtle energies here. I think one of the reasons that the aqua formulas are so powerful is that the mechanism for conduction of those subtle energies through the biological world, at least, is water. And because I guess we're working in that very realm, and we have had a profound effect on many people. But as far as how homeopathy works, you know, if we leave it as it has an impact on subtle energies, and therefore it's a technology that doesn't follow the law of mass action where more is better, that is the reason why in some cases one drop is all that's required. John's invented a nomenclature called a K-dose, where you put one drop of a formula into a glass of water, fill it up with water, throw the water away, and then refill the glass. And it's the tiny fraction of that dose that was wet on the inside of the glass that provides the focus for dilution. And in some cases, John has found that he can do that 3 and 4 times, to the point where conventional science tells you that there's only a possibility that there is even one molecule of the original active material left in the glass. However, it works. Now, I'm not going to argue with the fact that it works, and I'm not going to suggest to you that I understand in all its detail what this subtle energy is, but I would just simply offer that as the explanation in this situation. And it is, I must say, as I mentioned, as a scientist, the one part of all of this that I still find myself questioning from time to time, but the simple test for me is to stop using the aquas for a period of time and then use them again, and I'm quickly convinced that they do work.
How do you know that the aquas are safe to take?
I think the answer to this is one based on the 15 years of experience that we have with that product. Very early in the piece, I suggested to Leonie that we should go through all of the regulatory processes for medicines in Australia, and so the aquas were taken through a regulatory process with the Australian Therapeutic Goods Administration, the TGA. Now, they are reputed to be the toughest regulatory body on the planet, and having worked with them and now in a number of other regulatory regimes worldwide, I would say that the TGA would be close to the toughest regulatory authority on the planet. And we did manage to get the aquas through the process of listing. As a consequence of that, we've had to keep for that 15 years rigorous records as far as adverse reactions. We've had to document every single adverse reaction to anyone taking the aqua formulas over that period, and we have to submit a report on that every year. And I'm very pleased to say that over that 15 years, the file has exactly no pieces of paper in it. There has not been one adverse reaction to the aqua formulas that's been documented in that reporting system over that 15 years, and that tells me that we're dealing with a very, very safe form of management tool, and we're really proud of that record. It's I think an enviable one in the natural products industry, and it's one of the reasons that I'm so comfortable talking about the aquas in any forum.
I've been a runner my entire life, and I've just recently begun thinking about running marathons. If I take aquas, and I do, can I be disqualified because I'm taking the aquas?
You know, Robert, we've never approached the World Anti-Doping Agency and asked them to test the aquas, but given that they're homeopathic medicines, I suspect if we did give them some to test, they would tell us there's nothing in the bottle. I think you're pretty safe there. Performance enhancing, well, perhaps, but only in a good way.
There is a very small quantity of an alcohol in the bottles.
Yes.
And some people are allergic or somewhat concerned about that. Some people, I think, are putting the drops in very warm or even hot water. Is there a problem with that if they do something like that? And the concern is about the alcohol that's in the drops.
That's a realistic concern. And as I think you and I have spoken about, Leonie and I have looked over the years at other types of extracts to use. There are glycerol extracts of some of these materials that could potentially be substituted, but all the testing we've done suggests that they don't work nearly as well as the alcohol extracts. The amount of alcohol that's in the aquas, once you've put a couple of drops into a glass of fluid, fruit juice and water or water, in relative terms is very, very tiny. But I do know that some people put it into warm or even hot water. Now, traditional homeopaths and certainly flower essence would tell you that those types of remedies are generally quite sensitive to extreme temperatures, so I don't think I'd be putting the aquas into extremely hot water just to drive off the alcohol. But again, in kinesiological testing, we have tested, we've taken the aquas on and off planes many times through x-rays, tested them and found them to be indistinguishable from bottles that haven't been subjected to that kind of radiation. We've tested them, having sat in the boot of a very hot car for days, if not weeks, and again find no deterioration of their efficacy in that situation. So we believe them to be pretty robust formulas, but by the same token, I'm not sure I'd be putting them into boiling water or leaving them sitting in the bright sunlight on the kitchen counter every day. But they do seem to be reasonably resilient.
this particular approach to helping the body hydrate is really an incredible invention. I am really amazed at how well it works for me. My question for you as one of the two developers of this is, how in the world did you figure this out?
Even though Leonie and I are the remaining two business partners, there were actually four of us in the very early days, and so I will give credit where credit is due to our former business partners and the co-inventors of the formulas. Their names are present on our patents, which have been granted worldwide on these formulas. So I do want to recognise the fact that there were more than just Leonie and I involved. But the process was a very interesting one. I guess it was a combination of a sort of first principles approach where there seemed to be some potential ingredients that could be implicated in having an effect on hydration mechanisms, together with a pretty detailed iterative approach where we did, you know, try a variety of different formulations, testing to see which was the best, together with, I suppose, some, you know, either inspiration or divine guidance, depending on your perspective on those sorts of things, which led us to this particular formulation, which stood apart from all of the other formulations that we tested, all of the other pathways we went down, quite dramatically. So it was clear that the particular combination, which is ensconced in the patents, is quite a unique synergistic combination of ingredients, and then the final formulations that find their way into the aqua formulas were the result of some further development in order to get the gender specificity and the time of day specificity. Yeah, I'm not sure it's a process I could ever expect to repeat. I think it just had to be all the right people and factors in the right places at the right times that led us to the outcome. But I must say we're pretty proud of them.
John Coleman does recommend to people with Parkinson's that when they begin taking the aquas, they start with one drop, but they take them every day. Leonie talks about taking a break every day dosage. And she even suggests take them during the week and then Saturday and Sunday. Just take a break and don't take them.
Yep.
Can you explain then what that's all about and why a person might want to or not want to take a break from taking the aquas?
Sure. There's a couple of components to that process. Firstly, the idea of using them and taking periodic breaks, be that the, you know, 1 or 2 days over the weekend or longer breaks less frequently, comes from the concept in traditional homeopathy of proving a remedy. So the thinking here is that if you take a remedy on an ongoing basis, then you can reduce its effectiveness, because as these things work through an energetic process, somehow the sensitivity or the gain in the system gets turned down with repeated exposure. Now, you'd probably be better talking to a classically trained homeopath than me to explain exactly what the origins of that thinking are, but we always included that as part of what we recommended with the aquas. And again, partially that was came from simple empirical studies. We found that in our study group of people that were using the aquas, that they seem to get a better ongoing effect if they had periodic gaps in the use of the formulas. As far as John's point of view on this, I guess he's using them for a very particular endpoint and as a much more therapeutic tool. We, when we conceived the aquas, saw them as something that we would use to enhance someone's hydration and work towards building improved wellness, whereas John is using them for a particular therapeutic endpoint. And certainly his studies with his study group suggest that daily use is useful in those people. So I guess it's just a reflection of two slightly different intended uses and, you know, also perhaps demonstrates the flexibility of these sorts of formulas.
Should someone who is very, very ill take the Aquas?
I think that someone that's very, very ill would only use the Aquas in collaboration with a well-qualified health professional, because even though they are working on something as global as hydration, because it is so global, you know, it is possible, I suppose, that someone who's very ill may see some sort of perturbation of whatever they're doing as far as other therapies and so on. This really only became apparent to us when we started working with John, and he suggested to us that, you know, the normal dose for him actually caused a partial or temporary worsening of his Parkinson's symptoms, with the consequence then of an improvement. But certainly initially he was, you know, he and we were quite put out by the fact that he seemed to worsen initially. So I think someone who's unwell who's very unwell needs to be careful with any of these sorts of natural products. I mean, one of the, I think, quite reasonable questions that the conventional medical establishment asks is, why is it that people automatically assume that natural products are safe? Because there's plenty of things in natural products that aren't safe. So I think we need to approach these things with the same measure of care in someone who's particularly unwell. Having said that, I think most natural products, you know, are safer to use in someone who's generally well, because all the mechanisms are already in place in a well body to cope with whatever we consume as food and whatever. But certainly in someone who's extremely unwell, probably a practitioner's intervention or involvement in the decision-making process is useful.
Some people tell me that they drink water all the time, but they're still thirsty. What's going on?
Well, I think what's going on there, and we talked about it earlier, is this long path and short path hydration. I think that what happens in someone who is dehydrated is that they can pour a significant amount of water into their system, and it has little or no impact, and the consequence is they remain dehydrated and remain thirsty. And it's in exactly those sorts of people that something that provokes the long path hydration, where the water actually winds up going into the cells. And in the case of someone who remains thirsty, particularly into the central nervous system, because the thirst reflex is mediated through a center in the brain, which sits very close to the central ventricles. And unless we're able to actually rehydrate central nervous system, that center isn't going to sense that anything's changed, and it will continue to put out a thirst behavioral cue. So I think this is a classic example of this long path versus short path hydration.
Chervoslav, after this long series of questions, is there any question I haven't asked that I should ask you now?
I often find myself talking to athletes about the particular ways that I found were useful to use the Aquas, and there, quite simply, it was a matter of using them before and after training and competition, and frequently I'd actually add some to water bottles when I was able to carry those with me, as I often did when I, you know, went for a bike ride or something like that as a bit of cross training. But no, I think we've pretty much covered it.